From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our holiday week series, Songs from Hollywood and Broadway. We'll hear from the lyricist who asked the question, "Is this the little girl I carried?" Sheldon Harnick wrote the lyrics for the show's Fiddler on the Roof, Fiorello, and She Loves Me. We'll also hear singer Barbara Cook. She starred in the original productions of She Loves Me, and The Music Man, and Candide. More recently, she's been described as the high priestess of cabaret. Songs from Hollywood and Broadway, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Search crews have found two more bodies in a canyon in Southern California where mudslides engulfed two camps yesterday. The discovery brings the death toll to six, with at least 11 other people missing. Tracy Martinez of the San Bernardino Fire Department says rescuers found extensive devastation at the camps.
What happened was two buildings washed away, and we do believe that there were folks in one of the buildings. And it washed straight down. The road is covered, and I would say a good 15 feet high of mud and debris. Lots of large trees, you know, 20, 30 foot, 40 foot trees up there as well. A lot of boulders.
Heavy rains caused the mud to slide from hillsides that were stripped of vegetation by this fall's wildfires. Two calves from the Washington State cow with mad cow disease have been quarantined, but federal officials say it's unlikely that the disease was transmitted from mother to calf. Aaron Hennessy reports from member station KPLU in Tacoma, Washington.
The Department of Agriculture says a widening investigation is focusing on finding the birth herd of the infected animal that's been slaughtered. The cow was likely infected from eating feed containing animal parts. That type of feed has been banned since 1997. Since the disease takes 4 or 5 years to develop, they believe the cow ate bad feed early in its life. The USDA's chief veterinarian, Dr. Ron DeHaven, says tracing the origin of that feed could take a while.
My hope is that we will be able to identify that location within a matter of days, but we have no idea what we might be able to find or not find in terms of records that will lead us there.
Both of the calves under quarantine are in Washington State. One is at the same dairy that was home to the animal stricken with the brain-wasting disease. For NPR News, I'm Erin Hennessy in Tacoma, Washington.
Officials in Iran say thousands of people have been killed by an earthquake in the southern city of Bam. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports that the quake struck in one of the most geologically active regions on Earth.
Earthquakes are strikingly frequent in Iran. Iranian news sources say about 950 quakes have hit the country since 1991, killing more than 17,000 people before today's earthquake. With preliminary casualties now reported to be in the thousands, this latest quake could be one of the country's worst in recent years. The earthquake was reportedly a magnitude 6.7. Quakes in this region are especially deadly because many buildings are made of mud or masonry. Geologists say this quake occurred as a result of stresses where two giant plates in the Earth's crust meet. They say the movement created a sideways slipping in an as-yet-undetermined fault in Iran. In 1981, two devastating earthquakes struck just 60 miles north of this one, killing 4,500 people. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
In stocks, the Dow gained 19 to close at 10,324. This is NPR News. Hopes may be fading for the robot explorer that was meant to land on Mars on Christmas Day. British scientists who built the Beagle 2 lander say no signal has been detected that would indicate the vehicle landed safely. Alistair Wanklin reports from London.
For many hours now, radio telescopes have studied the Beagle's probable landing place. It was meant to slow to a halt under parachutes and on air cushions. Mission controllers in Britain say while the Beagle might have crashed, it may simply have landed off course or have a radio fault. One project director said it's a frustrating time. He said it's like waiting for the reply to a love letter that you know someone's received. But space scientists say even if the Beagle is written off, the rest of this European Mars mission is going well. An orbiting craft called Mars Express, which carried the Beagle to Mars, is performing well and will later search for water and other signs of possible life on Mars. For NPR News, I'm Alistair Wanklin in London.
Authorities in Istanbul say they've broken up an al-Qaeda cell suspected of carrying out two deadly bombings in the city last month. The bombings left 62 people dead and hundreds injured. A state security court in Istanbul charged 9 people with terrorist-related crimes, including one man believed to be a leader of the group. The governor of Istanbul told reporters that a total of 44 people have now been charged in connection with the bombings, which were aimed at two synagogues, a British bank, and the British consulate. In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index gained 4 points to close at 1,973. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, reminding listeners that more than 31 million Americans are at risk of hunger every day. On the web at helpstophunger.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're celebrating the holidays with a week of songs from Hollywood and Broadway. Today we'll hear Terry's 1988 interview with one of Broadway's great lyricists, Sheldon Harnick. With his former collaborator, Jerry Bock, he wrote the songs for Fiddler on the Roof, Fiorello, She Loves Me, Tenderloin, and The Apple Tree. Harnick and Bock ended their partnership in 1970 after their musical The Rothschilds. In 1965, Harnick won a Tony for Fiddler on the Roof, which also won Best Musical. A revival of Fiddler opens on Broadway in February with Alfred Molina as Tevye the Milkman. Of all his musicals, one of Harnick's favorites is She Loves Me. It opened in April of 1963 and closed 8.5 months later. Let's hear the title track from the original cast recording.
She loves me, and to my amazement, I love it, knowing that she loves me. She loves me, true she doesn't show it. How could she, when she doesn't know it? Yesterday she loathed me, bah, now today she likes me, ha! And tomorrow, tomorrow, ah! My teeth ache from the urge to touch her. I'm speechless, for I mustn't tell her. It's wrong now, but it won't be long now before my love discovers that she and I are lovers. Imagine how surprised she's bound to be. She loves me. She loves me. I love her. Isn't that a wonder? I wonder.
Let me ask you a couple of things about the title song that we just heard.
Mm-hmm.
The initial rhymes are really repetitions. She loves me, but she doesn't show it. How could she when she doesn't know it?
Mm-hmm.
What goes through your mind when you're using, say, two its instead of rhyming an it with a sit or an it with a bit, but to reuse that word?
Oh, that's a different kind of rhyme. The rhyme is not it. If you'll notice, the accent is on the prior syllable. Show it, know it, and that's done all the time. If it were one word, it would be like action, faction.
Mm-hmm.
So that the rhyme is not necessarily on the last syllable. It's where the stress is, and in those cases, the stress is on show and on know.
I like the line, "My teeth ache from the urge to touch her."
Well, that's an extremely personal line. I was trying to use myself as George, and I realized that there are situations with some women where whatever the feelings are, they get me right in the back of the teeth. Now, I had a friend who, not having had that experience, he said, "What kind of a line is that?" He said, "I love you, and my foot hurts." You know, so it was very personal to me, and I just hoped that other people either would identify with it or at least understand what I was saying.
I want to play the opening number that you wrote the lyrics for She Loves Me. This is called Good Morning, Good Day. But before we hear it, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the function that this song had to serve within the play, because opening numbers are really important. They have to set the tone for everything that's going to follow, and they frequently have to introduce the characters as well.
Right.
What are some of the functions this song had to play when you were writing it?
Well, the main thing that the song did was to set the tone of the show. And for good or for bad, it's a gentle tone. It's not a razzle-dazzle opening number. Also, the number lyrics and music interweave with some of Joe Mastaroff's dialogue. So it was really a delineation of character at the top of the show, the people we were going to be spending the next 2 hours with. And mostly it was that. It was getting you to know them, getting you to get a sense of the fact that they're comrades in this shop that they all work in.
Okay, let's hear a part of Good Morning, Good Day with the lyrics by my guest Sheldon Harnick.
Good morning.
Good day.
How are you this beautiful day? Isn't this a beautiful morning?
Very.
Hey, see, boss, how's this?
That's a very elegant pose, but is all that elegance necessary?
And why not? I represent Marichex, don't I? We're not a butcher shop or a hardware store. We're a perfumery, and that means we're
stylish.
That's it.
With a quiet dignity.
Yes, and we get the tilt of our hats right.
That's right.
When I ride my bike, people see what Marichex like. So I think it's very important that I look my best. Here comes Miss Ritter.
Miss Ritter.
Good morning.
Good day.
How are you this glorious day? Have you seen a lovelier morning?
Never.
It's too nice a day to be inside shuffling soap. I have no more energy whatsoever. Does anybody mind if I take the day off? Arpad, why aren't you old enough to take me away from all this?
I'm old enough.
Then marry me and I'll put my...
When you're writing a lyric, do you find that you frequently throw out the first few versions of it before you come up with the one you like? Or are you lucky enough to hit on it the first time?
Well, what I find is quite often the first version of a lyric, it's not that the lyric won't be technically good, and the idea may even be good, but what I find is I don't know the character well enough yet, so that as my acquaintance with the character deepens, then I will look at that lyric and no longer be satisfied with it and think, no, that's really not what the character would say at this time, so that I throw it out and start over again. And if I'm lucky, I'm able to salvage some of the better lines from the song.
Do you allow yourself to use the same rhyme twice in different songs?
I'm not entirely sure I know what you mean.
Say you used a rhyme 15 years ago in a song.
Oh.
And those particular words will work just fine in a song you're working on now. Will you rule it out because you already used it once?
If it's a trick rhyme, yeah, I'll rule it out. Sometimes, of course, you don't remember. What's more difficult, I once asked Ogden Nash, a man I loved, and I loved his work. I was his assistant for a television show years ago called Art Carney Meets Peter and the Wolf, so I got to meet him and work with him. And I said, what happened? Well, how do you feel if you write a rhyme that you feel is original with you, and then you hear another song, an earlier song, where that rhyme has been used? Do you have to go back and rewrite? And Ogden started laughing. He said, oh my, he said, I write rhymes and I'm so proud of myself. I think they're fresh and new. And then I find out that Larry Hart wrote them 20 years ago. And he said, all I can tell you is if you feel that you've created that rhyme, then use it. He said, there's no reason to change it just because someone else has. And as a matter of fact, I've started reading poetry late in my life, in the last 8 years or so. I've been going through poetry. And I find with Browning and with Lowell and people like that, they've used all of those complicated rhymes a century before we did.
What are you learning from reading poetry that applies to songs?
I think what I'm learning is that the great poets, not even the great poets, the minor poets, all good poets, have a genuine care for using the right word in the right place. And it makes you want to, it inspires you to do the same, to be careful, to write with as great care as possible so that you really express what it is that you yourself are feeling.
You never write pop songs, at least not that I know of. All of your songs are written in the context of a show.
Right. I learned very early that that was not my talent. I was quite disappointed when I discovered that, because when I came to New York from Chicago, it was with the idea of being another Irving Berlin, writing for the theater and having songs come out of it that were pop hits. I hadn't been in New York too long when I had four songs in an off-Broadway review called The Shoestring Review, and they got very nice press. So I was invited up to meet a publisher in the pop field, and I played them my stuff. And after I did, they said, well, your work is too filled with ideas. It's not simple enough for what we want is something much simpler. And I thought, I guess that's true, but I write complicated most of the time, or at least I do try and put ideas in. I thought, well, if that's the case, that's the case. Then the other experience was, after I had met Jerry Bock and we started to work together, there was a period when we didn't particularly have a show to work on, so we worked on a lot of what were meant to be pop songs. And we didn't sell any of them. And at a certain point, we looked at each other and thought, well, that's not what we do. So I was hoping that ultimately some of the songs from the shows would become standards, and that's what happened. There's been a few.
Mm-hmm. Before you started working with composer Jerry Bock, you were writing music for your own songs, and I think it was Yip Harburg, the lyricist who's probably best known for writing lyrics to The Wizard of Oz, who told you to stick to lyrics. Was that good advice?
Yes. Well, it certainly facilitated my career. What he did was to tell me that in his estimation at that time, this was the early 50s, that there were more capable theater composers than there were capable theater lyricists. So what he actually said was, if you can facilitate your career by agreeing to collaborate with other composers instead of writing music yourself. And that's what I did. Shortly before he died, as a matter of fact, he told a good friend of mine, Madeline Guilford, who was a very close friend of his, my name came up in a conversation they were having, and Yip said, I wonder if I did that young man a disservice. He said his music was fine, but I wanted him to get ahead faster, so I wanted him to work with other people, and I hope I didn't steer him away from writing his own music.
I think one of the things that would be really nice about writing lyrics to somebody else's music is that you've got a variety of lines to write to. That you've got, if the music's coming first, you have somebody else's lines to fit your words and rhymes to, and that there'd be less of a possibility of getting stuck or of rewriting the same song.
Well, there's always the possibility of getting stuck, but what is wonderful about writing with someone else, there's two things that come to mind. One is that music, although people consider it as an abstract art form, music to me is very concrete. Music says certain things, so that when I hear a piece of music, when Jerry used to give me a tape with a lot of new music on it, music suggests ideas, music suggests emotions and moods, and I would find myself getting ideas for lyrics that I wouldn't have had if I hadn't heard those pieces of music. So that was wonderful. The other thing is, as you were implying, one of the difficult things to create in writing a lyric is the form of the lyric, or at least it's difficult for me. Maybe other people don't have that problem. But to create a fresh form is not always easy. And when someone gives you a piece of music, the form is there. So you don't have to worry about that. All you have to worry about is the other things, singability and clarity and rhyme and things like that.
Stephen Sondheim, back at his lecture on lyrics that he gave at the New York Y years ago, this was in the 1970s, said that you were one of his favorite lyricists and that he liked your work for its grace, its charm, and its perfection of setting. And I think that perfection of setting has really been an important one for you. And I think of the different kinds of settings you've had to write for: Fiorello, which is about New York politics; Fiddler on the Roof, which is set in an Eastern European shtetl. I mean, those are two really different extremes that you had to write lyrics for.
Mm-hmm. I do my research, and as a matter of fact, I think that accounts for the least successful show that I did.
Which one?
The first one with Jerry Bock was called The Body Beautiful. And I accepted the show because I was very hungry to get a show on Broadway, but it was not the show I should have done. It was about boxing. And boxing was a sport and a milieu that I really had almost no interest in. So although I did my research, my heart wasn't in it.
Sheldon Harnick speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is lyricist Sheldon Harnick, whose shows include She Loves Me, Fiorello, and Fiddler on the Roof. We'll return to his conversation with Terry Gross in a couple of minutes. In 1971, Harnick presented an evening of stories and music at the famed Lyrics and Lyricists series. Here he is, telling a story about writing one of his most famous songs for Fiddler on the Roof. And then, we'll hear Zero Mostel from the original cast recording.
It's very seldom that Jerry Bach and I have written for stars. We always write for the character in the show. In this case, in Fiddler, by the time we got around to this song, Zero Mostel had already been signed. So the song was written with him in mind. Jerry Bach and I had gone down to see a Hebrew Actors Union benefit. We thought we would maybe find some people down there. And a mother and daughter performed a song, a wordless Hasidic song, all in thirds, and Jerry was so taken with this song that he went home and he wrote this tune to If I Were a Rich Man. He played it for me, doing all these Hasidic sounds. And we thought, wouldn't it be nice if we could find a lyric that preserved some of those sounds? But so I couldn't sing those sounds. So to help myself, I wrote Digga Digga Deedle Diddle Dum. And during rehearsal, Zero said, listen, is it okay if I do bum bum bum? And I said, go ahead, I can't do that, but I would be pleased if you would do that. So he did.
Dear God, you made many, many poor people. I realize, of course, that it's no shame to be poor, but it's no great honor either. So what would have been so terrible if I had a small fortune? If I were a rich man, all day long I'd biddy biddy bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a biddy biddy rich, idle diddle 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 man, I'd build a big tall house with rooms by the dozen right in the middle of the town. A fine tin roof with a real wooden floors below. There couldn't be one long staircase just going up and one even longer coming down. And one more leading nowhere just for show. I'd fill my yard with chicks and turkeys and geese and ducks for the town to see and hear, squawking just as noisily as they can. And each loud will land like a trumpet on the ear, as if to say here lives a wealthy man. Oh, if I were a rich man,
all day long. Well, Fiddler on the Roof, which was a very unusual setting, the Eastern European Shtetl, was one of your most successful shows, one of the most successful shows on Broadway, probably. This was one of the shows that you initiated the idea for.
Right. A friend had sent me a novel by Shalom Aleichem, a book called Wandering Star, about a Yiddish theatrical troupe touring all over Russia and Poland. And I loved it, and I gave it to Jerry Bach to read. He loved it, and we gave it to Joe Stein to read. Joe read it, and he said, it's too sprawling. It covers 40 years. It has a cast. I mean, it has about 80 characters. It's just too big, he said. But the writing is wonderful, and it's very inherently musical. Why don't we look for more things by Shalom Aleichem? So we did, and we found the Tevye stories, which we then optioned and began the project ourselves.
Lyricist Sheldon Harnick is my guest. We were talking before about songs that do and don't have lives outside of the show, and you said you always wanted to write songs that would have a life outside of the show. I think the songs in Fiddler on the Roof certainly did, and I think especially of Sunrise Sunset, about how many weddings that
right.
song has been sung at. Have you been to weddings where they sang that song?
I've not only been to weddings where they've sung that song, but I have a number of friends who've asked me and my wife to sing that song. For instance, Alan Alda's daughter got married, and one of his daughters got married, and Margie and I sang there. So we've sung the song ourselves at a number of weddings.
Can I ask you to recite the lyrics from the song?
I think I think I can remember the first chorus anyway.
Okay.
Is this the little girl I carried? Is this the little boy at play? I don't remember growing older. When did they? When did she get to be a beauty? When did he grow to be so tall? Wasn't it yesterday that they were small? Sunrise, sunset, swiftly flow the days. Seedlings turn overnight to sunflowers, blossoming even as we gaze. Sunrise, sunset, swiftly fly the years, one season following another, laden with happiness and tears.
What came first in that song when you were writing it?
The music. I remember it very vividly. Jerry Bock was living in New Rochelle at the time, and I would take the train out there. We would go into his basement where he had a studio, and he played me the music for Sunrise Sunset, and I was so moved by it. I had the experience of having lyrics kind of crystallize on the notes. It came out very fast, very rapidly, and we were both so thrilled with it that we called Jerry's wife, Patty. We said, come down. She ran down to the basement, and we played it, and she wept.
That was a good sign, huh?
Yes.
Lyricist Sheldon Harnick speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. He wrote the songs for She Loves Me, Fiorello, and Fiddler on the Roof, which is being revived on Broadway next year. More in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air.
Is this the little girl I carried? Is this the little boy at play?
I don't remember growing older. When did they?
When did she get to be a beauty? When did he grow to be this tall?
Wasn't it yesterday when sunrise, sunset, swiftly flow the days. Seedlings turn overnight to sunflowers, blossoming even as we gaze.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Myrowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett. Available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. And from Starbucks, offering access to NPR holiday programming through the T-Mobile Hotspot service. Available at neighborhood Starbucks during this holiday season. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with lyricist Sheldon Harnick. And we hear singer Barbara Cook. She starred in the original Broadway production of Harnick's show, She Loves Me, as well as the original productions of The Music Man and Candide. Now she's one of the top cabaret singers.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. We're celebrating the holidays with a week of songs from Broadway and Hollywood. Before we return to Terry's 1988 interview with lyricist Sheldon Harnick, let's hear another story about Fiddler on the Roof from his appearance at the 92nd Street Y Lyrics and Lyricists series. This excerpt is also available on the expanded edition of the Fiddler on the Roof original cast recording, now out on CD.
Along the way, we dropped a number of songs from Fiddler. One was a song that made a large part of the audience uneasy. I seem to have a talent for that. The song was called When Messiah Comes. It occurred towards the end of Act Two, where Tevye and the villagers have been ordered to leave Anatevka. Someone says, wouldn't this be a good time for the Messiah to come? And Tevye and the others did the lyric I'll sing for you in a moment. I felt that it was a perfectly valid and somewhat bittersweet notion to have Tevye present a picture of the Messiah as having a guilty conscience. But apparently many of the audience found the notion irreligious. Others were uneasy because they weren't certain how to react. For all I know, you'll feel uneasy too. When Messiah comes, he will say to us, I apologize that I took so long. But I had a little trouble finding you, over here a few and over there a few. You were hard to reunite, but everything is going to be all right. Up in heaven there, how I wrung my hands when they exiled you from the promised land. Into Babylon you went like castaways on the first of many, many moving days. What a day and what a blow. How terrible I felt, you'll never know. Since that day, many men said to us, get thee out. Kings they were, gone they are, we're still here. When Messiah comes, he will say to us, don't you think I know what a time you've had? Now I'm here, you'll see how quickly things improve. You won't have to move unless you want to move. You shall never more take flight. Yes, everything is going to be all right. When Messiah comes, he will say to us, I was worried sick if you'd last or not. And I spoke to God and said, would that be fair if Messiah came and there was no one there? And the Lord replied to me, wait, everything will be all right, you'll see.
Sheldon Harnick singing a song that didn't make it into the final production of Fiddler on the Roof. Now let's return to Terry's 1988 conversation with Harnick.
Did you learn about writing songs in settings by some of the early work that you did for industries? You wrote a lot of industrial shows, I think, for places like Esso and Nabisco, Buick. What did you write songs for them?
They had an interesting policy. They used standard music, and my job was to take the material they did, the points they wanted to make. Most of the shows I did were for salesmen, either introducing a new product or a new slogan or just making them more enthusiastic about what they were doing, so that my job was fitting this material into existing music. They felt that it was enough to give their audiences the message without asking them to absorb new melodies as well. And as a matter of fact, later they got sued for this because I didn't know at the time that they hadn't been paying the composers. As a matter of fact, I did a long lyric to the Meredith Wilson's song Trouble, and somebody who was in the industrial show that we did was a friend of Meredith Wilson's, and he called Meredith Wilson, not to complain, but just to say what fun it was doing this new lyric to Meredith Wilson's tune. And Wilson, of course, was shocked. He said, what do you mean? Nobody asked me for my permission. But what that experience did for me was to refine my craft. because especially for an industrial show, everything had to be done with the greatest possible clarity, the greatest possible economy, and the greatest possible effectiveness. So it was learning to hone my skills.
Do you remember any of the lyrics you wrote for those industrials?
Oh, no, that was...
too long ago.
Huh? That's too long ago. That's about 30 years ago.
When you're looking at a book that you're going to be writing the lyrics for, how do you know where the songs go? What makes the place in a Broadway book for a song?
Well, there can be a number of different places. One, of course, which we're all taught, is that one looks for the emotional high point of the scene, where the emotion is so strong that the words want to start soaring. Instead of just being spoken, you want the addition of music to deepen the emotion. But also, there can be a spot, oh, for instance, in Fiorello, as Jerome Wideman wrote the book, he had a scene in a political clubhouse where the men were playing poker. And I thought, oh, my, I played a lot of poker in the Army, and I remembered a lot of the colorful lingo that went with poker, and I thought, I want to use that lingo for a colorful lyric. So I spoke to Jerome Wideman, and I said, I want to borrow some of your lines, and I want to change a large part of this poker game into music. And he said, be my guest. He was very generous, so I did that.
Do you miss Broadway when you don't have a show that's open there?
Well, there's two things about Broadway that no other venue can provide. One is the immediate launching of a show. When you do a show on Broadway, even a flop, people know about it all over the country. And if it's a hit, they may know about it all over the world. Whereas if you start a show that's a success in some other city, little by little, it has to make its way into the news and it has to make its way into the stream of things that get produced. And then, of course, for a writer, the other thing is that the money that comes in for a Broadway success is enough to enable you to devote your life to writing. If you don't have that kind of royalty coming in, then you have to teach or you have to find another profession that will support you to support your writing habit.
You haven't had to do that, have you?
Not since Fiorello.
Right, which was a long time ago.
Yeah.
One last question. When you're writing lyrics for a song, where are you? At the piano, at the desk, on the couch, driving in the car?
I'm various places. Where I prefer to be when I start is in a reclining chair. And on a little end table next to the chair is my thesaurus and my rhyming dictionary if I need them. But I like to be quiet and calm and just in a position to think and hoping that the phone won't ring because I'm a compulsive answerer. Then, once the lyric is started and it reaches a point where I'm excited about what I'm doing, then it can be on a subway, on a train, walking around the city. In fact, I have to be careful that I don't walk right out into traffic.
I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Lyricist Sheldon Harnick speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. Coming up, Tony Award-winning singer Barbara Cook, who starred in one of Harnick's best-known musicals, She Loves Me. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. We're celebrating the holiday week on Fresh Air with songs from Broadway and Hollywood. We just heard from lyricist Sheldon Harnick, who wrote She Loves Me. Now let's listen to an interview with Barbara Cook, who brought those lyrics to life. She's been called a high priestess of cabaret and one of Broadway's most beloved lyric sopranos. On Broadway, she originated the role of Marion the Librarian in The Music Man and starred in Oklahoma, Carousel, and Leonard Bernstein's Candide. Terry spoke with Cook 10 years ago. Now she's preparing for her Metropolitan Opera debut on New Year's Eve. Here's Barbara Cook from the 1957 cast recording of The Music Man.
There were bells on the hill, but I never heard them ringing. No, I never heard them at all.
Terry asked Barbara Cook about her early Broadway career. She had sung before Broadway, but she made her acting debut in her first Broadway musical, Flahouli.
When I first started doing them, I had never acted. And when I got Flahouli, I was just floored because, you know, I really hadn't been here long trying to do this. And I got a leading role, Jerome Cortland. And I played the, the juvenile and ingenue roles is what you would say now. And the thing is, though, we didn't have secondary roles. They were the primary roles, so that the storyline hung on our storyline. So we had a lot of responsibility as far as the show goes, and I was very nervous about it. I was convinced all the time that I was going to be replaced by somebody in the chorus any minute, you know, so I was quite nervous. I'm a nervous person. Listen, I'm just finally beginning to settle down a little bit in my old age.
how has nervousness affected you over the years?
I don't know. I guess I just went ahead and did it anyway. I'm surprised sometimes when I think about it how I was surely one of the most nerve-wracked people you've ever known.
Well, what were the symptoms?
Oh, well, my hands would perspire so much that, perspiration would just drip off the palms of my hands. Honest to God, I'm amazed. And I was just always so nervous about how people going to like this or think about that. And it took me a long time to settle that. I don't know. And yet, at the same time, I always had a lot of confidence in my singing. So there's that dichotomy there that I don't completely understand. For instance, in Flahouli, as I say, I was sure I was going to be replaced any minute, and I developed all kinds of nervous ailments that I'd never had before. And I remember we were in Philadelphia trying out the show, and I remember coming in one evening saying to myself, if this is what it's like to do musical comedy, I've got to try to find something else to do. I can't stand this. I can't take this. And at the same time, I remember hearing an orchestration for the first time for one of my songs. And I wasn't able to phrase a particular line in the same way that I had in rehearsal and the way that I wanted to do it. And so the conductor, Maurice Levine, said, Barbara, you know you're going to have to do this a little differently. And I said, but Maurice, you know, that doesn't work that way. Change the orchestration. And he said, Barbara, we can't change the orchestration. It's expensive and other than. And I said, well, Maurice, you know, they hired me to do what I do. And I can't do what I do with this orchestration like this. So they changed it. But when I think back, that doesn't sound like somebody who's very scared, does it?
No, it sounds like someone who has chutzpah.
Yeah, doesn't it? So I don't know, those two things existed side by side.
So you had confidence in your singing, but maybe not so much confidence in either you as a human being or something?
You got it. Right there, you said it.
in your early days on Broadway, you had the image of the ingenue. Now, what exactly does that mean?
Well, I don't know. A lot of the roles I played were not really ingenue roles. I just think I looked so much like an ingenue that people thought of me as the quintessential ingenue for years. Certainly, for instance, when I did Oklahoma, I didn't play Laurie, which is, well, even Laurie's not really so much of an ingenue. She's a very spunky lady. But I played Ada Wanny. I played the comedy role. And the first time I did Carousel, I played Carrie. I didn't play Julie. It was only later on that I played Julie, who's really like a leading lady. So then when I did Candide, Cunegonde is like a cartoon of ingenues. She's a cartoon. And she finally, at the end of the show, she's a very old lady with a hump on her back. And, you know, it's yet I've been tagged with this ingenue thing. Isn't that funny?
So did that affect the image that you thought you were supposed to have?
I think maybe it did. I guess it did. I don't know how. I didn't think about that so much until you just said it.
One change that I know happened in your life, and this was a physical change, is that there was a period, I'm not sure how old you were, when you ended up putting on a lot of weight. And I imagine that changed the kind of roles you could get even.
Well, yeah, sure, absolutely. I for a while I thought that my memory of that time was that I wasn't being sent things to do, sent scripts, I mean. But that's not true. I was being sent scripts. I just didn't want to work, I think. I think it was that period when I was sort of shifting over from playing all these kind of youthful roles, and I didn't know quite where to aim myself. Do you know? It was an awkward time. I think I would have felt guilty if I just said to myself, well, I'm just going to take a few years off here. And so I think that's maybe one reason why I started gaining weight. I don't know. It sort of gave me an excuse to not work. I have no idea. Listen, if I knew, I'd tell you.
Right.
Boy, I don't have a clue.
Right. So what effect did it have on your work as an actress and as a singer?
Well, it kept me from working, I think, for a while there. And then what happened is in, 1973, I did a long tour all through the summer and into the fall. It was a concert of all Gershwin material. It was the 75th anniversary of Gershwin's birth. And it was sort of a big year celebrating Gershwin that year. And that was the first time in a long time that I had sung as myself, if you will, rather than singing as a character. And I loved doing it. And I remember saying to one of the agents involved, gosh, I really would like to do some cabaret. And he said, but Barbara, there's no place to play. And within a year, cabaret had a kind of renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time 74 rolled around, Wally Harper and I decided to get together and see what we could come up with. And in the middle of 74, we went into a little place called Brothers and Sisters. And we had been asked to come in for a couple of weeks, and then we stayed the whole summer. So we were there for about 7 weeks. And then, believe it or not, the next stop was Carnegie Hall. Carnegie Hall with a live album being done. Because what had happened was when we were at Brothers and Sisters, Herbert Breslin, who is the manager for Pavarotti, had heard us and had decided to do this concert.
Barbara Cook speaking with Terry Gross in 1993. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1993 interview with singer Barbara Cook.
I know you've said that two of your great influences musically were Judy Garland and Mabel Mercer. And what interested me about that is that they're really opposites as performers. You know, Judy Garland was very emotional. There was always this tragic aura about her on stage. Whereas Mabel Mercer was very regal. She sang everything as an art song and sang with a certain amount of emotional distance in a way. You never felt she was necessarily singing about herself.
That's interesting.
And she was just so regal on stage. And I'm wondering what in terms of stage presence, if you felt you took things from each of them.
Well, when Judy was here at the Palace, there's a little after-hours club. It used to be called the Little Club. It was called the Gold Key Club. And it was a private club. You had to have this little gold key if you were a member to get in. And I knew the man who played piano there. Very often she would come over after her performance and sing some more for herself and for her friends. And so when she was going to be there, he would call me and I would come in so I could hear her do this stuff just for herself. And having a chance to observe her so close, I really learned a lot I never had any coaching per se. My voice teacher mainly was interested in technique, but I haven't had a lot of help with how do you sell a song or put it over, if you know what I mean. What I think I learned from Garland during those months was to think about shaping a song so that it had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and so that it had a kind of emotional line. Do you know? Not necessarily the musical line, because I think I learned that working on Candide more, but that it had an emotional line. And that was something that hadn't occurred to me before. And with Mabel, she had this very idiosyncratic way of using words that could be so effective. That and also her take on a lyric was so personal. I'd never heard anybody have that kind of personal take on a lyric. Do you know what I mean by that? Her sense of irony was so strong, and I think actually her sense of humor in a song was greater than anybody I've ever heard. She broke so many rules. She sang consonants. You know, and you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to sing vowels and get off the consonants.
Now, explain what you mean by that.
Well, for instance, a word like wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we would be told to hold that wah, you know, to hold that, because that's how you get the sound out, and to get off that next N and D as fast as you can. Wonderful. But, or to sing wonderful, do you see?
Mm-hmm.
But she would do things like wonderful.
Yes.
And it's more wonderful. So I learned that kind of thing from her.
Gee, you know, you're absolutely right. I never
and
noticed that.
A song like Remind Me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you were just going to sing that straight, you might sing, Remind me not to find you so attractive. Remind me that the world is full of men. But she would sing, Remind me not to find you so attractive. Remind me. Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely.
So, you got to be judicious with that stuff. But, boy, she sure as hell knew how to do it, I'm telling you.
Well, that probably gave you permission to do things, too, that you discovered on your own.
Sure. I think so.
Do you think your voice has gone through different periods as you've gotten older?
Well, most voices do change timbre. They get darker.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I don't have those light, high notes like I did during the Candide days. But, you know, I have other stuff. I have a much greater ability to put emotion into a song.
Mm-hmm.
Much greater ability than I had in those years. It's amazing. When I used to do those cast albums, the albums were done the second Sunday after we opened, or the third Sunday soon after we opened, and I found that as I played the show, I found more and more things, and I liked the performances better, say after 3-4 months. You know, what used to happen is in the show albums, I was feeling so much. And I was getting maybe 1/8 of that into the voice. Do you know?
Yeah, now how do you find a way to get that in?
Well, I guess it's just confidence in doing it.
It must be really good to like how your voice is changing and feel, you know, more expression going into it. And...
Well, yeah, I do. I, of course, I'd like to be able to do everything. You know, I want to still be able to sing Q over X up there, but I can't do that anymore. But it's okay, because I got other stuff that I really like better if I had to choose.
Broadway singer Barbara Cook speaking with Terry Gross. She'll be performing in The Merry Widow at the Metropolitan Opera on New Year's Eve. We'll continue our celebration of music from Broadway and Hollywood on Monday.
Grab your coat and get your hat. Leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hirschfeld. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
I used to walk in the shade with those blues on parade, but I'm not afraid. This rover crossed over. If I never have a cent, I'll be rich as Rockefeller. Gold dust at my feet on the sunny side of the street. Grab your coat and get your hat. Leave your worries on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear a pit-a-pat? And that happy tune is your step. Life's sweet on the sunny side of the street. I used to walk in the shade with those blues on parade, but now I'm not afraid.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as we continue our holiday week series, Songs from Hollywood and Broadway, we remember three great songwriters. We feature interviews with Frank Lesser's daughter, Susan, Oscar Hammerstein's late son, Jamie, and Jimmy McHugh's grandson, Jim McHugh III. Join us for the next Fresh Air.